All material from this presentation can be found on our website. Jennifer Renix, SACE's Federal Policy Director, will provide an overview of the midterm election results and then some initial analysis on how the outcomes may impact efforts to develop and enact climate and energy policies at both the state and federal levels in the coming months. Again, thank you for joining us. I will now turn this presentation over to Jennifer Renix. Jen?
Okay, hello. Can everyone hear me? Well, I guess nobody can respond, but thank you, Courtney, and thanks to all of you for joining us this afternoon. As Courtney said, my name is Jennifer Renix, and I am the Federal Policy Director for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. As everyone on this call I'm sure well knows, this week Americans decided the outcome of more than 509 major contests. There were more than 100 ballot measures, and over 6,000 seats in state legislatures were chosen across the country. And you can see the specific numbers in each category here. Next slide, please. Now, midterms are often decided by the so-called party faithful, and that's a sentiment that actually may have been understood as many years ago as 200 years ago, as one of our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, noted in this quote. This midterm actually saw slightly higher participation rates than in past midterm cycles, and I think this was due in part to several factors. There was certainly strong anxiety about the economy and jobs. There were quite a few tight races in several states, and we saw very good weather across most of the country. All of those helped bring a slightly higher turnout, but still abysmally low. I think most of us would agree that 42% of registered voters bothered to turn up. So now on to the results, please. Next slide. So as I'm sure many people on this call know, the Democratic Party will still control the United States Senate chamber, and there are still two races being decided, but it looks like the final count will probably be 53 Democratic seats to 47 GOP seats, and the pickups are noted in the dark red color there on the screen. If Senator Murkowski prevails in Alaska, that's the one that is currently coded in green, she will be only the third senator ever to successfully mount a write-in campaign, and she would be expected to caucus with the Republicans. And I just want to note that each of the next few maps here are from the New York Times Election Center, and as Courtney said, all of these materials are already being loaded onto our website this afternoon. Next slide, please. Now, in the House, on the other hand, Republicans did gain control of the House of Representatives with a decisive 60-seat pickup. This was in line with most of the polling models that were estimating anywhere between 45 and 65 seats. There are still 10 races that are undecided, as I have noted there, and it appears that the final count for the 112th Congress is likely to be approximately 242 Republican seats to 193 Democratic seats. And this contrasts starkly, as I'm sure many of you are aware, with the current Congress, the 111th Congress, where there are 255 seats that the Democrats control and 175 seats that the Republicans control. So these numbers have somewhat reversed, although not quite to the extremes that we're seeing right now. And you'll note there on my slide that each state in the Southeast, with the exception of Kentucky, had at least one pickup for the GOP. And I will discuss the possible recount in North Carolina when we get to that state's slide. Next slide, please. Moreover, the Republicans gained a dozen governor's mansions across the country, and this is contrasted to the modest Democratic gains of only two out west. Here in the Southeast, there were two pickups, Florida and Tennessee. Florida is considered a pickup because the current governor is an independent, and that moved to Republican control. And there are still four races being decided. It appears that the final count will be 29 GOP-controlled governor seats, 20 Democratic-controlled governor seats, and a single independent that was won in Rhode Island that night. And one thing that I want to really stress here is that there are nearer-term implications for these gains in the governor's mansions beyond simply budget setting or veto power over the next 4 years. There are several key swing states likely in the 2012 presidential election, most notably Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, that all changed from Democratic to Republican control. So that is worth noting that there could be implications in the very near term for some of those swings. Next slide, please. And the final big picture look here is that there were changes in many state houses across the country as well. 19 chambers in total changed control, including two here in the Southeast, Alabama and North Carolina. And in both of those states, both the House and the Senate flipped. In both cases, it was the first time since the mid to late 1800s where both chambers flipped at the same time. And beyond the Southeast, there were other states, mostly in the Midwest, where the parties changed as well. All right, next slide, please. And the reason I highlighted with the state general assemblies is the shifting power in these state legislatures is very significant because state governments are responsible for redrawing congressional districts in accordance with the 2010 census that has just concluded. And the GOP now has a much stronger voice in that process in multiple states, and most especially for those of us on this call, including several here in the Southeast, where gains are expected. The official information has not been released, but we expect to see likely two new congressional seats in Florida, one in Georgia, one in South Carolina. There's a possibility that North Carolina could have a pickup due to registered military as well. So these are some high-level results here from Tuesday's elections at both sort of the national and big-picture regional level. And now I'd like to spend just a few minutes looking a little more closely at the outcomes within the Southeast specifically. And I define the Southeast as the eight states where the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy most closely tracks. That would be Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Kentucky, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia. And I wanted to go ahead and specify those states because some people define the South and the Southeast in different ways. Okay, next slide, please. And another thing I want to point out here, throughout this portion of the webinar, if you see a bold italicized name, that indicates a new member of Congress. And if you see a green bolded italicized name, that indicates a change in party as well. So, therefore, Alabama will be returning Senator Shelby to D.C., along with three new congressmen, including one pickup there for the GOP. Next slide, please. And in Florida, nearly one-third of the delegation will be new members, and that includes four pickups for the GOP from the Panhandle all the way down to South Florida. And two of the closest watch races in the whole country, whether or not you are from Florida, I'm sure you know that there were two very closely watched races. In the governor's race, it was a bitter and very closely divided race, and the Republican candidate, Rick Scott, narrowly defeated the Democrat, Alex Sink. And I believe this victory has implications for climate and energy policy because Scott is a climate skeptic who has said, and I quote, "I have not been convinced," when he was asked about climate science, whereas candidate Sink had acknowledged the impacts that could result from climate change, and she had stated her support for renewable energy standards, believing and talking about how this would spur clean tech investment. And the other closely watched race in Florida was for the open Senate seat, and in that case, a rising star and Tea Party favorite, Marco Rubio, won handily against two challengers. He had both a Democratic and an independent challenger. And once again, this victory, I believe, has significant implications for the climate and energy work we do in our region. Senator Martinez, who Mr. Rubio will replace, had voted in favor of a climate and energy bill in the Senate in 2008, the last time one was brought to the floor, whereas Senator-elect Rubio has done what many feel is a 180-degree turn with regards to climate policy. He now expresses doubts about the science and has indicated his opposition to climate policies. And then, as you can see, there are going to be quite a few new representatives heading as well. All right, next slide, please. Georgia was one of the more stable southeastern states in terms of election returns. Senator Isaacson handily won re-election. And all House members but one were successful in their re-election bids. Georgia's overall support for clean energy policies is likely to be unchanged, despite one changed seat there, as the defeated Congressman Marshall was not supportive of the House climate and energy bill last year, and he had somewhat sporadic support for various clean energy policies that had happened in the subsequent or the preceding years. And then in a race that actually was a lot less close than people had predicted, former Congressman Nathan Deal was elected governor in Georgia. And that will probably not be much of a change from the Georgia administration that we have there currently with Governor Sonny Perdue. Okay, next slide, please. In Kentucky, Kentucky is actually unique in this presentation in that it is the only state in the Southeast that did not see a change of party for any seat. There's only one new member who will be heading to Washington, and that is Senator-elect Rand Paul. And both Representatives Yarmuth and Chandler did hold their seats despite tough re-election bids. And I want to note here that both of those gentlemen supported the House Energy and Climate Bill from their base in the heart of coal country there in Kentucky. So this, in my mind, partially debunks the myth that climate support led to a loss of seats. There has certainly been some conflicting media coverage on this, and I'll have a little bit more on that later. Next slide, please. In Mississippi, the delegation exactly reversed itself in a single election. It went from three Democratic and one Republican member to three Republican and one Democratic member, as you see there. Next slide. In North Carolina, this is one of the few states where there's a question mark right now. North Carolina may see one seat change parties, but North Carolina's 2nd District is still technically undecided. The margin of victory for the challenger is currently, or at least the last time I checked, at approximately 450 votes. That is well less than 1%, which can and often does automatically trigger a recount. So we will be watching to see whether or not that seat changes hands. And otherwise, Senator Burr will be returning to D.C. and may, and this depends on the outcome of Senator Murkowski's bid, our North Carolina Senator Richard Burr may become the ranking minority member in the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. And something to point out here is that, interestingly, he ranks number 3 in the country, not our region, but in the country, for contributions from oil and gas corporations. He has accepted more than $200,000 in his 6 years in the Senate, whereas the woman who is currently the ranking minority member, Alaska's Senator Murkowski, didn't even rank in the top 10 for this election cycle. So that was an interesting fact to me. Next slide, please. We have seen some fairly significant changes in South Carolina over the last few days. South Carolina's congressional delegation is going to be changing quite a bit. You can see there long-serving Democrat John Spratt. He is currently the chair of the House Budget Committee. He lost his re-election bid, and I do point out this is a notable change, as Congressman Spratt had a very solid record of supporting clean energy policies, and the Congressman-elect Mulvaney is a climate skeptic and has publicly opposed policies to limit carbon pollution, so that is certainly to be a change. In total, 4 new Republican congressmen will head to D.C. This is due to retirements, there were primary challenges, and then that one seat pickup. Another closely watched race around the country was in South Carolina for the governor's seat. And in that race, State Senator Nikki Haley made history at 2 levels. She is both the first Indian American woman governor, and she will be South Carolina's first woman governor. And right now, to be honest, little is known about her positions on climate and energy policy, other than the fact that we do know she supports offshore drilling, and she has expressed vague opposition to what she considers cap and tax policies, but has not really been specific on her position on climate and climate pollution. It is unclear, and this is something certainly our organization, and I would welcome and encourage all organizations we work with, it is unclear whether she will become a strong champion of South Carolina's burgeoning wind energy industry that is growing up in the state for the new jobs that it can create. But just a week ago, one of her fellow Republicans, U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham, recently appeared at a groundbreaking ceremony in North Charleston, along with who is the sole remaining Democratic member in the South Carolina delegation, Jim Clyburn. There was a groundbreaking ceremony for a new offshore wind turbine drive train testing facility that is going to be testing some of the largest offshore wind turbine blades in the world. And so certainly there is going to be a small micro community there growing up around that, and we are very hopeful that the governor will be supportive and lead in that way. And also in South Carolina, Senator DeMint, who is an avowed climate skeptic, he was easily reelected to another term, so there is no change in that. Next slide, please. In Tennessee, there were also significant changes. There were three congressional seats and the governor's mansion that all changed parties. From a clean energy perspective, our organization is certainly very hopeful that Governor-elect Haslam will continue to be as supportive of clean energy as he has been while mayor of Knoxville, Tennessee, which is part of the American Solar Cities program. At a recent event, he had called solar energy a viable alternative to coal and fossil fuel-generated electricity. So we hope and certainly look forward to the fact that he may be helping to recruit more billion-dollar investments there in Tennessee in the coming years to join the ranks of Hemlock Semiconductor and Wacker, which were part of the outgoing Governor Bredesen's work. And in Tennessee, it is unclear whether the three incoming GOP congressional members who will replace three Democratic Blue Dog members or fiscally conservative members of Congress, it is unclear whether that will mean significant changes in Tennessee's support for clean energy policies, as neither retiring Congressman John Tanner nor defeated Congressman Lincoln Davis supported last year's House Energy and Climate Bill, and both had somewhat mixed records on support for clean energy policies in general. But unfortunately, it does appear that the three who are going to be replacing retiring and defeated congressmen there are not in favor of clean energy policies. So we will, time will tell. We will wait to see. Next and final state slide there. In Virginia, there were also several seat changes. There were three freshman Democrats who lost their reelection bids, and you can see those names marked there. So next slide, please. Here is a likely overview of what the 112th Congress bi-party affiliation will look like. And you'll note here in the southeastern region in particular, we have almost a 2-to-1 ratio of Republican to Democratic members. And those numbers have certainly shifted a bit over the last few years. And one interesting point I just wanted to point out here is that in the House of Representatives in the southeast, there may be two African-American Republicans that would join the Congressional Black Caucus, one from South Carolina, one from Florida. A CBC member, Representative Emmanuel Cleaver, had noted yesterday that both of those members would be welcome to join based on their race, so it remains to be seen whether they will join that progressively-leaning caucus or not. So here, you know, with first impressions of where we are, I would certainly say, obviously, pendulum swings have always occurred in midterms, almost always. And we have certainly seen that in this election. This midterm absolutely had mixed signals. Some said it was a referendum on the presidency and the president's agenda at this point. Others say, well, it's just a predictable realignment following 2 years of a single-party control in Washington. So right now what we're looking at is shared power within the Congress. The two chambers will be controlled by separate parties. And then also there will be a bit of shared control between the Congress and the White House. So next slide, please. There have been so many metrics that have been used to describe this election, and in addition to many of those geological descriptions that I'm sure we're all a bit sick of hearing, landslide, earthquake, tidal wave. But here's a few that I think are most pertinent to our region and or for energy policy work, so I wanted to share them. There were some headlines calling Tuesday a reckoning on climate and energy. But I wanted to point out and actually to stress here that it's worth noting that Democrats who voted against the climate bill were three times more likely to lose their seats than those who voted in favor. And those first few statistics there bear this out. You can see that 80% of Democrats who supported the bill had won their races, and 75%, in fact, of the Republican members who supported the climate bill either won a race or were promoted onto another position. And that is really in sharp contrast with 62% of Democrats who voted against the climate bill. They either lost their races or, if retiring, they saw their seats flip to a GOP challenger. A couple of other by-the-number stats here. Sadly, only 9% of the voters were ages 18 to 29, and that is a marked contrast compared to 19% just 2 years ago. So as a whole, I think you can make the conclusion that young people simply didn't vote, certainly not in numbers in this cycle. And in doing so, they conceded the election to older voters, which tend to have differing philosophies and differing interests. And then another very interesting stat that I just came across was that 25% of the Democratic caucus was defeated on Tuesday, a quarter of the caucus. That actually equaled 60% of the land area, and some are calling this election a rural revolt. Try and say that three times quickly. And you can certainly see this in some of the big states where there was only a single representative, North Dakota, South Dakota. And when those parties changed, that certainly meant a big-looking change on the map. All right, next slide, please. A few more by-the-number stats here. Next year, sadly, not a single African-American will serve in the Senate. And this is despite the fact that African-Americans comprise upwards of 12% of the U.S. population. And here in the Southeast, that number is actually above 26%. So unfortunately, that is a backward sliding number. And thanks to the Citizens United ruling, which I'm sure many people are aware of from earlier in this year, candidates didn't need to run negative campaigns this time around. Outside groups did the dirty work for them. And it was record spending. Approximately $450 million was spent on races at the national level alone. That did not include state spending. And I want to point out this was five times more than was spent in 2006, just one midterm cycle ago. And unfortunately, because many of the donations to political action committees can be done anonymously as a result of that Supreme Court ruling, it will be impossible to know exactly how much of the money came from energy interests. So that's something we're just certainly going to have to grapple with as we move forward. And yet, from a clean energy perspective, now that I've gotten everybody very low here, I just want to point out there was a ray of hope from the West. In California, two out of three voters approximately rejected attempts to roll back the nation's first state-level climate bill. So that certainly was good news from Tuesday night, despite some of these other less happy tidings. So these are the outcomes that are, you know, raw data and numbers. But I wanted to spend the last few minutes of the presentation before we move on to questions looking at what some of the possible implications are of these election data for climate and energy policy moving forward. And I'm going to look at this sort of through three lenses, a legislative, a committee-based, and then a regulatory point of view. So next slide, please. In the president's press conference yesterday, he acknowledged that it was doubtful you would be able to pass a climate bill like passed last summer, like the ACES bill, again anytime soon. But he stated, and this I quote, he said, "I don't think there's anyone in America who thinks we have an energy policy that works." He was very upfront. This was literally in the first few minutes of his speech. So he really made a broad plea here and encouraged Congress and other elected leaders to find what he referred to as areas of broad agreement, where we could find areas to compromise and work together, perhaps moving forward with energy policy in chunks and pieces as opposed to in one fell swoop. And he mentioned a number of different options a few different times, both during his formal speech and then again during question and answer afterwards. Some of the policies he specifically mentioned, some of the options were natural gas development. He mentioned that more than once. Energy efficiency incentives were mentioned early on, unfortunately not later in the speech. He did talk about electric vehicles several times and renewable energy clean tech deployment. So that is certainly heartening news, and we hope that people take that to heart as they move forward. From a legislative point of view, could a GOP-controlled House offer up something similar to what Speaker-elect Boehner introduced last year? He introduced something called the American Energy Act, which calls for ramping up nuclear energy and offshore drilling, but also creating incentives for renewable energy as well. So that is something that we may see a similar form of that again. And something I'd like to point out now, I've actually read this numerous times here in the last few days. It will be really interesting to see how Tea Party-backed members with a fiscally conservative platform are going to react to proposals for increased government subsidies for energy policies that would direct arguably massive amounts of money for programs such as carbon capture and sequestration, the so-called clean coal technologies, nuclear expansion of drilling. How will they justify doing that if they do it while maintaining their mandate for smaller government? I believe it truly remains to be seen how this process will play out. I certainly encourage everyone to watch it closely. I will certainly be doing so myself. So, in summary, from an administrative and from a legislative point of view, we have been told in several instances now cap and trade, which was the House-passed energy bill last year, is simply one way to skin a cat. The president used those exact words. So it's certainly only one way of addressing the problem of global warming pollution, and if people are open and interested, there are other options that we need to be willing to discuss and look into. Next slide, please. The committees are going to be interesting here as we move into the 112th Congress. The chairmanship of various committees will shift simply by the nature of the party shift. So Energy and Commerce Chairman Henry Waxman of California will be replaced. The question is who. It may be Congressman Joe Barton of Texas, or it may be Fred Upton of Michigan. This is depending on seniority and internal GOP rules on term limits. And I need hardly say there would be significant implications for the direction of the committee work in terms of who gets this committee chairmanship. Joe Barton, as I'm sure many of you remember, he was the one who apologized to BP officials for what he called a government shakedown during the House's Deepwater Horizon hearings, which was very clear indication of where his sympathies lie. And the other potential name, and due to term limits, I think the more probable chair for this committee would be Fred Upton of Michigan. And I've read various commentary on him. He would likely be a more moderate leader on energy issues. He has previously supported limits to domestic energy production on federal lands, which certainly went against the grain of party votes. And he was one of the co-authors on the piece of the bill passed in 2007 that banned incandescent light bulbs. And that was passed as part of the 2007 energy bill. And I point this out as a way of saying that this could be very important moving forward, and maybe just as a sideline show here, but Tennessee Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn, who does sit on this committee, has just recently co-introduced a new bill that would lift this ban on incandescent light bulbs, which unfortunately, you know, is a bit of he said, she said going back and forth here, but it would roll back some of the really important efficiency gains that were set forth in the 2007 energy bill. So if you have someone chairing the committee who has ownership of a part of that bill, I think we'd be far less likely to see some of those actions moving forward. Some other thoughts here on committee leadership and changes. It is unclear whether the House Select Committee on Global Warming and Energy Independence will even be maintained. Some critics complain it doesn't serve a legislative role. It's simply there for fact-finding and reporting. So if some budget hawks are looking for a way to trim spending and shrink government, as it were, this could certainly be let go. As I've already mentioned, the ranking minority, although not the chairman's gavel, but the ranking minority member of the Senate Energy Committee will depend on the Alaskan race. And there's talk of committee investigations that would come up, and certainly the chair of the Energy Committee or other committees as well would be free to investigate government reports on global warming science findings and implications, would be able to look into the oversight of the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to regulate carbon as a pollutant under the Supreme Court decision. And the Clean Air Act, but I would point out, particularly in the Energy Committee, they have a very wide mandate. They look at health and biomedical research. They look at commerce. They look at consumer protection. They look at communications, interstate transport and commerce. I mean, there are so many issues under their jurisdiction. Energy is one of them, even though it happens to be the lead of the title of the committee. So I think there's going to be a crowded playing field, and it is unclear right now exactly how deep investigations may go. Next slide, please. And finally, there are certainly implications for how and if current carbon regulation goes forward in light of these congressional leadership changes. President Obama has noted before and noted again yesterday during his press conference that the EPA still has a legal obligation to regulate carbon pollution due to the human health impacts. So he has made it clear that while he's open to compromise, he is not going to walk away from this Supreme Court directive. So that is certainly something that we will continue to watch and support. It is not an exaggeration to say that legislative threats to the EPA's tailoring and tailpipe rules and other rules that are coming out to deal with this directive are almost guaranteed, virtually guaranteed, that there is going to be threats to those in both chambers in the coming years. So this provides for all of us involved, I think, a very clear objective for both supporters, unfortunately also for opponents, to organize around. And lastly, it is unclear whether the decision to regulate coal ash as a hazardous waste, this is one of the two options being considered by the EPA right now, it's unclear whether that would influence current energy and future energy policy going forward, or whether that rulemaking process might even be impacted by funding pressure from Congress. And we really don't have a very clear timeline. We hope to see that decision next year, but it could take longer for a final rule to be published. But certainly how that decision comes down will, we believe, impact some level of energy policy decisions moving forward. So next and last slide, please, and then we'll move on to questions. We certainly know the outcomes of Tuesday's races right now, for the most part, in terms of raw data, and I think and trust that many of us acknowledge there is tremendous inertia in our energy systems. And there are still unknowns as we move forward here. I think many on this call believe that we are truly at a crossroads. We're either going to change path or we're going to continue along with diminishing and polluting fuel sources. And those are really two very stark paths that we look at. And for example, just the two pictures I put up here, I think, say it well. You know, within just a few weeks this summer, or spring actually, we saw the long-awaited approval for the first offshore wind farm here in the United States, back-to-back with the worst environmental disaster in our nation's history. So those two couldn't be more stark in terms of what we would consider offshore energy resources. But, you know, I would like to leave us on a slightly optimistic note here and say that I truly believe the clean energy gains that can be made in the coming months and years are not insignificant. They can include a whole suite of measures from clean tech investment, improvements in energy efficiency, renewable energy standards, deployment of electric vehicles, further improvements in vehicle mile standards to go along with the ones that have already been passed, and perhaps a transition to lower carbon fuels. And it goes without saying that each of these measures would reduce carbon pollution, even as they help us be leaders in the 21st century's clean tech economy. And that's something that President Obama said very clearly in yesterday's press conference. He said this would be the greatest competition in this century moving forward. So I do want to encourage people with the thought that each of these options already has bipartisan support in the Congress. Each of the ones that I just listed there have support and have had support on both sides of the aisle, and may find support in some of our state legislatures and from governors as well. So our role here moving forward on November 4th of this year as clean energy advocates and as concerned citizens, I think, is to continue focusing on the benefits that this clean energy economy would bring and to build support for these and other what we consider directionally correct energy policies to ensure that we do, in fact, lead the way and are not swept along against our will or in spite of ourselves. So thank you. Courtney.
Thank you, Jen. What a great presentation. I would like to just take a moment and orient everyone with our control panel on the right-hand side of your screen. Questions will be taken in the order which they come, which they are received. And we are going to begin with a question out of Georgia. Is there a place for peaceful protest? It appears that unrestricted corporate influence is making that the only available option. You have comment on that?
Yes, I mean, I would certainly urge and encourage that peaceful protest be part of everyone's toolbox here. We have seen peaceful protest that ends in arrests at multiple places around the country. We've also seen peaceful protest that simply results in media coverage and in helping to educate other people. There was a coal ash hearing in Tennessee approximately a week and a half ago, and at that coal ash hearing, there were dozens of university students who showed up for a rally that afternoon, and they were there saying, this is our future, this is not the direction we want to go, you know, hear us speak. And I think that's just one example of many ideas and activities that are out there that I think we definitely need to engage in to keep this issue in the front lines.
Thanks, Jen. And you can see pictures of that rally on our website. Next question, any comments on the House Ag Committee?
Wow, that is a good question. I am not sure on the House Ag Committee. I'm looking that up as we speak. On the Senate Ag Committee, and this is definitely not for sure, but it is something that I have heard, in the Senate Ag Committee, there is a possibility that Senator from Michigan, and her name is Debbie Stabenow, that she could possibly be in line for some thinking of leadership in that committee, because the current committee chair, Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas, has lost her reelection bid. So I don't know what kind of change we're going to see there in the Senate, although we will be seeing a change, even though the Democrats have retained control because the chair lost her bid. In the House Agriculture Committee, the current ranking minority member is a man named Frank Lucas of Oklahoma, and I am not familiar with him. That is not a state, obviously, that we track closely, so I will look forward to collaborating here and conferring with some of our allies. Certainly, the Ag Committee is of great importance to the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and I would suspect many people on this call, because the Southeast has such significant bioenergy resources. And so this is certainly something we need to watch closely and continue to engage with.
Great. Next question. Will the federal climate legislation help us with climate deniers like Governor Scott in Florida?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question again?
Will the federal climate legislation help us against climate deniers like Governor Scott in Florida, Governor-elect Scott?
Right. Well, because it did not get passed into law, at least has not yet, there are still several weeks left of this congressional session. There is no law or mandate coming from it, and so it certainly got support and it also got opposition. I don't know, given his strong and stated opposition to climate law, and he talks about being a skeptic. I think the route we're going to need to go with quite a few members of this incoming class, and that goes from representatives to senators to governors, because there are people being represented across all lines of the spectrum. I think we need to go back to some very serious climate science discussion and education. We have deniers who are not at all convinced that the climate science is real, despite the fact that report after report, panel after panel has come out, including ones under President George Bush's presidency, that have said this is real, this is happening. The question is not if, the question is when, and whether or not we implement the right policy measures to prevent, or whether we are looking simply at adaptation after the fact. So I could not stress more to everyone on this call that I think it's going to be absolutely essential that we continue to engage. These are our elected officials for the next 2, 4, or 6 years, and ducking our head in the sand like ostriches here is not going to be helpful. I think it's going to be very important that we continue to engage, and perhaps that is bringing some of our best scientists and continuing to bring scientists and business leaders to the forefront. We are not always the best messengers for this issue, although sometimes we are, but I think we have to be humble and acknowledge that a range of voices are going to be important here.
Thank you, Jen. The next question, can you list again some of the aspects of clean energy you think have bipartisan support? Which of these do you expect are most likely to be promoted in the next Congress?
Sure. And in fact, I can go into this presentation at a later time, and I can update the final slide with some of these bullets. I did not list them out, but the ones that I am aware of that already have bipartisan support, and this is not in a weighted order, this is not ranked, but clean tech investment, we've already seen some massive steps forward with the Recovery Act, the so-called stimulus bill with clean tech. We will, I believe, continue to see improvements in energy efficiency. Many people call that the lowest hanging fruit, so that is certainly something we need to go after vigorously. Renewable energy standards, more than 30 states and districts here in the United States have renewable energy standards, only one in the Southeast, and that is North Carolina. So that may be something that if you multiply 29-30 times 2, that should already be enough votes to pass the Senate alone. So gaining support for a renewable energy standard, we hope, would be something that would be viable in the coming months and years. Deployment of electric vehicles. This is something that has begun to get attention, certainly in light of the disastrous Gulf oil spill. If we had a more electrified fleet from clean sources, preferably, we would need far less fuel anyway, whether it's offshore, Mideast oil, or Alaskan oil. So electric vehicles, further improvements in vehicle mileage standards. We passed an energy bill in 2007 that increased the so-called CAFE, the Corporate Automotive Fuel Efficiency Standards, for the first time in it was 34 years. It was essentially the first time in my lifetime and many people's lifetime who have been working on this topic. But that doesn't mean that we can't go further in improving vehicle mileage standards. And the president, his administration, has already upped those slightly through some executive orders and work with the EPA. And then finally, transition to lower carbon fuels. We do have a renewable fuel standard that is on the books. It is something that may continue to be tweaked and hopefully strengthened. So all of those are clean energy gains that I think we need to be looking at, and all of them have some degree of bipartisan support.
Thanks, Jen. Next question. What would you rate the chances of a national RPS being passed in this Congress? That's the first part of the question.
Okay. Well, in this Congress, and that means in the final 7 weeks of the year here, there will be at least two different times when members of Congress go back to D.C. for regathering and figuring out next steps, and that's called a lame duck session. We expect to see one the week before Thanksgiving, and then we may see another one that goes for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks after Thanksgiving. There are some continuing budget resolutions that must be passed to keep the government going, so it appears likely that some amount of legislation will occur in that time. Renewable energy standard is certainly on a lot of minds. There are numerous co-sponsors. The last time I heard, I think we were up to 35, 36 co-sponsors in the Senate. A renewable energy standard has already passed the House of Representatives, so those two measures could be reconciled in a conference committee if it was done very quickly. But unfortunately, a renewable energy standard is one of multiple energy issues that will be crowding the plate along with other. There's some food safety issues that are going to be brought up, as well as other issues as well. I really don't know what percentage I could put on it. I think a renewable energy standard probably has a better chance than some of the other policies simply because it has already passed one chamber, and it has gained steady and strong support in the United States Senate before. So I would give that one a better chance than some of the other policies that are out there. But there's also tax extenders for renewable energies and biofuels. There's reauthorization of diesel emission funds, trying to clean up our diesel reductions, and energy efficiency measures that are trying to go through. So there are a lot of things, all of which we are supportive of, but a lot of things crowding the plate.
Next.
And the second part of that question?
What are the chances of a bill to extend the grants in lieu of federal tax credit for solar being extended before the end of this year?
Well, that's again, one of the other things I just mentioned, renewable energy tax credits in terms of production tax credits and other tax credits that are possibly going to be lumped together with spending bills may be broken apart. That one, again, generally has support. The problem with tax credits is, it's not a problem. I mean, I consider it a good thing, but a lot of members of the Congress, particularly fiscally conservative members, believe in a pay-as-you-go, a so-called pay-go system, where you need to pass legislation that is paid for. And so in order to extend a tax credit, you need to find that money, because giving somebody a tax credit means less money is coming in as revenue. And so it has actually, there have been several different things that have passed through the United States Congress, both the House and the Senate, that are passing, for instance, biofuel credits and as well as production tax credits, but unfortunately they passed with two different measures. So they look like two slightly different animals, and they have yet to be reconciled or merged together. So again, that is another one that I believe is popular and has support. It just depends on how long people meet for and what kind of appetite there is to continue working, particularly for the members of both the House and the Senate who have lost their seats.
Thank you, Jen. If you have any additional questions, please submit them now. We're going to be wrapping up on the question and answer session. Next question. What would you say this election says about the best states for state-level renewable portfolio standards?
And would that be the best states that have yet to pass here in the Southeast, or the best states in general?
I think we can focus on the Southeast.
No, with that clarification. Based on our election results, and I did not go into great detail about what happened with state legislatures. Some of that is still being worked out, and to some degree that's just not the area where I focus, since I focus more on the federal policy. But We have not gotten clear indications that any of our southeastern states are on deck to move forward with a renewable energy standard. Now, South Carolina, and there are people on this call who are far more expertise in this than I am, South Carolina has had discussions about a so-called clean energy standard. There are some leaders and some advocates who have talked about that, but it is loosely defined, and being South Carolina would likely include nuclear as a so-called clean, a lower carbon source, which is not the same thing as a renewable energy source, solar, wind, sustainable biomass, hydro. So it is questionable whether or not South Carolina could move forward. Florida has taken repeated runs at this, but has thus far been unsuccessful, and that was at the urging of a governor who was supportive of this. Governor Crist, early in his four-year term, was a champion and did want to see a renewable energy standard pass in Florida. He saw it as a way to create jobs, and rightly so. But so the one state that has it, North Carolina, we hope will maintain it and in fact, perhaps strengthen at some point. But at the very least, that one is on the books, and I don't have a clear sense that any of our southeastern states are chomping at the bit to enact one now.
Well, thank you very much, Jen. And this is the end of today's presentation. I'd like to thank everyone for attending, and we've been very excited about this webinar series and celebrating our 25th anniversary. We hope that you join us next month. And again, this presentation and the audio recording will be posted on our website under webinar archives. Thank you, Jen, and I hope everyone has a lovely afternoon.
Thank you.